We have a long distance to go, and y'all are tired of visiting by now anyway, so. I told Ken he missed a good chance this morning. He had an extra 5 minutes he could have preached, but he didn't do it, so. But anyway, we enjoy visiting, and we're glad you're here. This is a continuing story about Noah and the Ark, and we're interested in building your concept of what that's all about. There's a lot of scientific evidence that it actually happened, as we saw, if we review a little bit here. There is a remnants of an ark just south of Mount Ararat in Turkey. It's been designated a historic site by the Turkish government. They say it's the ark site. And if you go there, there it sits down in a gully surrounded by mud and lava. It's been gradually ooching its way down the mountainside from an elevation of over 6,000 feet. How it got there makes no sense at all unless you know the story about Noah and the flood. And sure enough, there is the remnants of such a structure there. We've talked about what all of that means over the past month or so. And I've decided to extend the course 3 more weeks in December and cover some more material because it makes no sense to start a new subject then. I'll be teaching in January and February as well. And I didn't even ask Cleo if I could do this, but we're going to throw in 2 or 3 more topics before we finally close it down. I'll try to get that information for you ready next week. Today we're talking about one of the big criticisms that the critics have about the story of the flood, and they say, I don't care how big the ark is, how are you going to get thousands and thousands of animals on the ark? And so that has to be addressed in some way, and that's what we're going to talk about this morning. The animals on the ark. And we've seen this picture before. Spears drawing, showing the animals how they're all arranged around in little cages and shelves and whatnot all around, and they're struggling to get them all fed. We talked about the size and shape of the ark. From its remnants there, it appears to be pointed on one end. It's 515 feet long. It's almost half again bigger than most people had thought that it was. And we spent one whole Sunday talking about the fact that that's the right length, because we now know exactly how long a cubit was. And so that story was in, I think, the second lesson. And so we've got something that's roughly rectangular in shape, except the end that pointed into the waves had to be pointed like that. So we know about how big it is and what its capacity is. It has a window running around the top of the ark that admits light. And the ark breathes, as we talked about, because of its construction. Air is sucked in and out through that window that runs all the way around just under the roof. And also that emits light. But only the top deck would have light. There are 3 decks, and the thing is about 50 feet tall. I went out and stepped off the block on which we live over here in Cochran's Green Circle, and it's 540 feet long. So you could imagine this thing sitting in the street, 3 times the width of the street, of the streets around here, and a block long. That's a pretty good sized structure. It'll hold a lot of material. And not only, as we'll see this morning, not only did they have to put the animals in the ark, but you had to have the food for them for a year, more than a year actually. So there's a lot to be stored in the ark, and I think the bottom and the middle decks were probably used for storage, and the top deck is where you put the animals. That would make sense. We don't really know of any way to light it. having fire on the ark would be a possibility, but it also has some danger when you've got wood soaked in pitch. Yeah, that could create some problems. So probably it didn't. They may have had torches that they could carry down below decks when they went to sea, if they could retrieve some food or some equipment that they needed. Okay, so how do you put all of these animals, and how many animals? Not only, we're not asking how do you get them on the ark. God sent the animals to Noah, and they were loaded into the ark. Now, we don't know that every animal, every kind of animal that existed, was loaded in. There may have been some animals that God rejected, just as He rejected all of evil mankind in that flood. So there may have been some carnivores that weren't around in the beginning, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but that they didn't get on. And so we're not suggesting that he had saber-toothed tigers, say, or dinosaurs. We don't know. And he may have had some forms of dinosaurs on the ark that didn't survive afterwards. So there are a lot of these questions about the animals that we have to look at. So the ark, as we pointed out here, was 515 feet long, one end narrowed to a point with from a width of 86 feet. So we have a simple calculation to make that the area of the top deck where the animals would be kept was about 40,000 square feet. How big is that? How big is your Kroger store? Anybody know? You walk it, it seems like a lot, doesn't it?
The real big one's about
85,000? Yeah, so it's about half of that. It's probably half of a Walmart store, something like that. There's a lot of room there, but not room for a huge number of animals, as you can imagine. So how many do we need? So let's look at that. It's divided into rooms, and you have to have access to all of these rooms, so that you have to eliminate in your calculation hallways and walkways and stuff like that, because you have to haul in all this food to these places where the animals are kept. There's one other feature here that we have to look at. If you think about zoos in our day and age, there's some animals where you have to kind of keep your distance. They're somewhat dangerous. And some animals are hard to keep because they're afraid. Wild animals are afraid of man. Where did that happen? Well, that happens if you look in the 9th chapter of Genesis and verse 2, I think it is. The fear of man was put into animals and even fish after the flood. And we suspect that before the flood, they weren't afraid. Animals weren't afraid of man like they are now. That's not a natural thing, according to the Bible, that originally animals were not fearful of man. So they may have cooperated in many ways, and they may have been more easily trained under those circumstances. I don't know. That's a consideration that we have to put into the equation. All right. How many animals are there? Now here's an interesting diagram from a Time Life book that's 50 years old now, but the numbers haven't changed much. If anything, there's a few more species. Now, we're talking about numbers of species of animals. If you think about it, there are not as many frogs as there is everything else. Frogs and toads, the species. Now, we're not talking about the total number of any one kind of animal. We're talking about the numbers of different kinds of animals here. And so scientists have classified all of these animals into their different species. And that's what the scientist thinks of first, but of course he's trying to make an argument that you can't answer. And so when he talks about the number of species of insects, look at that, 700,000 different kinds of insects. And as a matter of fact, if you talked about the total volume of any one of these kinds of animals that we see here, what would you suppose is the biggest volume of body mass in the world? It's a rather surprising thing. First of all, you think about big animals. Well, of course, elephants or whales, but there's not very many of them in comparison. And when you think about the prevalence, the most successful animal on the earth's surface are the insects. You can kind of see that. And the insect that has the kind of an insect that holds the world's title for biggest body mass is the ant. Did somebody guess that? Ants. And you think about, well, there's a mound of ant, and there's maybe a million of them in a hill, and there are hills everywhere, and they occupy almost all of the earth. And if you dug them all up and poured them all onto a scale and weighed them, they outweigh everything else. The little ant is a mighty creature. But anyway, there's more insects than anything else, but the good thing about insects is they're not very big. So if you're just going to take a couple of pairs of most insects, it doesn't occupy a whole lot of space, and some of them can be carried under circumstances where they don't eat much and they just survive until you turn them loose again. Well, if we look up here, there's some we can eliminate. We don't have to worry about taking fish on board the ark. There's going to be plenty of water, and a lot of them will die in the flood, but many of them, almost all of them, will survive. Same can be said about what are called invertebrates here. Things like octopus and squid, things that don't have a backbone. And most of this, snails and things like that, most of them live in the water. Some of them do not, though, and will have to be carried on the ark. We have the birds, the reptiles, the mammals, and the amphibians. This is the class of organism over here that we're going to have to worry about if they're going to survive the flood. Fortunately, the birds, although he has to take 7 pairs of most of the birds, can occupy spaces they're small, most of them are small, can occupy spaces, even roosts, like in the picture up in the roof of the thing somewhere. You don't have to pin them up. And they're not going to get out. You might worry about them getting out through the window at the top of the ark, but that we don't know how that was opened and closed. But there's an indication that it could be opened and then it could be closed. And whether or not they had something like bars or screens on the windows to keep things in, we don't really know about that. Reptiles tend to be relatively small. There are some large snakes, and there were some very large lizards. And there were things, violent lizards, that the ancients called dragons. And the dragon seems to be the literary equivalent of the dinosaurs. So we just don't know about those, whether Noah took small versions, immature ones, and didn't have to take full-grown organisms, you see. And maybe they took up quite a bit of space. We really don't know. We're concerned mostly with the mammals here. There are not very many frogs and toads, and they don't take up much space either. But we got to look at that mammal category there, because there's 5,000 species roughly, and let's see how they're divided up. They contain most of the larger organisms that we're concerned with in this situation. Now, what is a kind of an animal? Scientists have made, since the time of Linnaeus, have made a system of categorizing and describing animals. We know the different kinds of animals that we see. The species is the unique thing that we look at and define, and then we group them into reducing numbers of categories beyond that. But God talks about kinds of animals, and he doesn't tell us how that is defined. Let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, and wild animals according to each according to its kind. And God made the wild animals according to their kinds. And so there were originally certain kinds of animals that God created. And we don't know how many or how dissimilar they were. We don't know what a kind of an animal is. We're going to have to kind of guess that. Now, the Lord had formed out of the ground. This is an interesting verse in the second chapter of Genesis. It tells us that the animals had been made like Adam had been made. They were formed out of the ground. And that's specifically said about man. And he says this at a time before Eve is made. We're still in the sixth day of creation, apparently. And God had formed out of the ground all the beasts of the field, all the birds of the air. Now, he's not going to name all of the animals, but just those categories. He brought them to the man to see what he would name them, and whatever the man called each living creature, that was its name. So the man, that is Adam, gave names to all the livestock, the birds of the air, and all the beasts of the field. So, we sort of skipped through that. We aren't given enough detail to know exactly how that happened. But you can imagine the scene where Adam is there, God parades before him a cow, and waits for Adam to decide what to call it. Now, he must have explained to Adam what we're doing here. You're supposed to supply the name. So what are you going to call these? And that's a daunting task. Have you ever tried to pick out a name for your kids? I mean, that's just one or two at a time, right? And yet you struggle with that for weeks before you decide exactly what you're going to call them. Now, he's got animals to name. I think it's possible that Adam took a couple of years to get this done, and that would preclude the idea that the days of creation were 24-hour days. The way we have looked at that classically in the past was to say, it says day, it's got to be 24 hours. Some of the first days occurred before there was a sun and a moon. I mean, we don't know how all of this was put together. And so the idea that they're 24-hour days, Adam has got to name these things in the day before Eve is made, and Eve was made on the sixth day too, just like Adam was. So there may have been some time pass here where Adam gets a few animals a day and God says, okay, your assignment for today is to name this set of frogs or this set of... Well, actually, he doesn't have to name all of the things that swarm upon the surface of the earth. That's a category here that isn't included in the naming of them. He's going to name all of the cattle, the livestock, and we know there were people who kept livestock. One of Cain's descendants, you might recall, was an expert at this sort of thing. The birds of the air. Now, there's lots of birds, but maybe they're not all so distinct. How much variation can occur in a kind of an animal as you give it time, as things happen down through the years? And we'll look at that in detail in a minute. So be thinking about that. Yeah.
Can I say just one word about the day? It may or may not be 24 hours. We know it wasn't thousands.
It wasn't thousands of years. That's right.
Because Adam was created on the sixth day, and he lived through some portion of the sixth day, the seventh day, and then he had children after that, and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not proposing that we're going thousands of years for the day. But we can't arbitrarily say there were 24-hour days. And in fact, I don't think the days that these men lived through were the same as the days that we live through. We live through 24-hour days, but there's some evidence that their days may have been a little shorter, maybe 20 hours, or maybe a little longer, 30 hours. We don't really know. We don't have anybody standing there with a stopwatch to time all of this. So we just can't be very arbitrary about it. But he goes through these animals, naming them, and although he doesn't name everything that swarms on the surface of the earth, apparently he did this, and it's not 5,000 different kinds of mammals, you see, is what I'm trying to say. Maybe there are, the first mammals might have been numbered in the hundreds, and that would be doable. But I would hate to think that I had to write a PhD thesis about thousands of these, and some students may set out to do that. But think about this as well, that the description of these animals as he names them has to be recorded somewhere. Now, God may have been keeping records for him, and so when Adam utters the name of a goat, we'll call this one goat in Hebrew, I don't know what it is, and then God records that. I think Adam was learning to write, and certainly he was learning, he knew how to speak. God gave him considerable abilities as he was created. And this all this before Eve. And it's pretty important, as we read in the third chapter, you'll notice what happens here, in the second chapter of Genesis. What happens next? I don't have it on the screen, but for Adam, after he was looking at these animals and describing them, he noticed that some were male and some were female, and God must have explained that to him. Okay? This is a goat. The male has horns and the female doesn't have, or a deer or something else where that's the case. But for Adam, no suitable helper was found, and he realized that these animals occurred in pairs, males and females. So the Lord God caused the man to fall into a deep sleep, and while he was sleeping, he took one of the man's ribs and closed up the place with flesh, and he took the tissues of Adam to make Eve, and formed her organs and her body and everything from Adam's tissues. Now, when the Lord made woman from the rib, he brought her to the man, and the man said, He knew exactly what was going on here, because he said, "This is now bone of my bones." So the man knew that the woman had been made from his bones, and that may mean that all of the animals had been made that way, that God made the male animal first, then took from him tissues to make the female animal. And you know, that makes a lot of sense, because to create an animal from the dust of the earth is a terribly difficult task. You've got to make the sequences of all of the genes and then get all of the enzymes working and then produce a living animal out of all of that. And God didn't do that magically. I think he did that with a lot of work. And when you talk about God resting after having created all of this, that may well be the case, that he was extended almost to the limits of his abilities to create all of these living life forms. Now, once he had made an organism, he didn't have to recreate the next one from scratch. He could borrow gene sequences and make DNA for the second organism, having done it once for another organism. And so the fact that all of life is related is not surprising, is the point I want to make from this. Because he's not, as an engineer, he's not required to recreate the wheel for every subsequent organism that he makes. And you could envision this in the pictures you may have seen of the descent of the automobile from the Model A Ford. The parts and the technology and so on can be borrowed from one to make an improved model. And the ones we drive today are the descendants of the others, but only because of the descent through the mind of the engineer who did that. So evolution, it takes two forms here. One is one can make another animal from the first animal, and all of the animals as they go along may change a little bit, or the creator may change his design as he goes along and make a series of animals that look similar because he's borrowed parts from the first ones that he made. Okay, so we don't know about all of that because we're not told, But Adam understood some things here when he was presented with Eve that suggested that some time God had explained some things to him, and that he knew about males and females, and he knew about procreation, and there would be children who would come from them. And for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother, be united with his wife, and they will become one flesh. That's a profound kind of conclusion for Adam to make just out of thin air. I think he had been taught that. All right. Well, we got to move on, but we'll come back to that when we talk about creation genetics. I just wanted to introduce that topic today. All right. Now, he's to bring into the ark two of all living creatures, male and female, to keep them alive with you, of every kind of bird, of every kind of animal. And what did they eat, incidentally? Well, he's got to store food for them, it says here. You are to take every kind of food that is to be eaten and store it away as food for you and for them. And he doesn't have to store living things for carnivores, you'll see here. These animals that God has brought to him, the food that they ate originally, to all the beasts of the earth, all the birds of the air, all of the creatures that move on the ground, I give every green plant as food, and it was so. And so they didn't eat flesh. They ate grain and plant materials and fruits and seeds. And that was the original plan. Now, some animals had become carnivorous. That means they ate other animals. But we don't think that was in the original plan God had. And who would have introduced such a thing? Well, of course, that seems to be something of the work of Satan, who introduced sin to man, and he probably changed the genetics of some of the animals, and probably where he did his worst damage was changing reptiles into fierce forms that were carnivorous. He had the ability to do that because he, as a cherubim, had been involved in the creation itself. Now, that story comes out of the book of Revelation, and I decided to put a special lesson in here where we're going to look at what I think, in my opinion, is a description of what was happening at the time of the flood, before the flood and after the flood, in the book of Revelation, in chapters 5, 6, 7, and 8. And so we're going to spend a Sunday on that. That's one of the extra lessons that we'll defer until December. But I think Satan had been at work among the... Where did all the thistles and thorns come from when God cursed the earth? I think Satan had produced some things that God allowed to give Adam a hard time when he tried to farm the land. All right. Scientific nomenclature. And this is sort of scary stuff if you're not interested, if you haven't studied it before. But all we're doing here is just trying to categorize animals. And all living forms fall into one of two kingdoms until there was a microscope, and then they said, okay, there's microscopic stuff, that's another kingdom of living things. And now there's five for those of you who look at this sort of thing. You realize that not only there are plants and animals, but there's fungi and there's two forms of microscopic organisms. That's the kingdoms. And among a subdivision of the kingdom Animalia, which you would guess are animals, are those that have a backbone. And the Chordata are those, and a subphylum of those of that division are those that have vertebrae. And so the vertebrates are the ones we're talking about here. And then among the vertebrates, there are the mammals, and we'll focus just on the mammals. And what you have here is the classification of a particular kind of mammal that's a primate and the family Hominidae and the genus Homo and the species Sapiens. And who's that? That's us. and so we're not so much interested in ourselves in this story. We know how many people there were on the boat. But let's look at another. We're looking at mammals. Now there are about... Oh, I got a little box there. I thought I had an about sign near the translation didn't come across from my Macintosh to the what's that other kind of computer? Anyway, so about 5,000 species we saw in an earlier slide, but there's only less than 1,000 genera. That means that there's about five or so species for each kind, on average, for each kind of animal. And then those are grouped into families of maybe 130 families. And so if we get back somewhere in the realm of the families between, maybe between what scientists call a family of animals or a genera of animals, we see that rapidly we could probably be dealing with a few hundred or maybe as many as 1,000 animals on the ark. And most of them are smaller than a house cat. And over 1,000 of the 5,000 species, 1,250 or so of the 5,000 mammals are rats and mice and squirrels. You knew the squirrels were numerous in our area. And rats and mice. And those don't take up much space, you see. There's only a few dozen that are bigger than a man. And so the problem isn't nearly as big as the critics try to make it. Question. Yeah, you could take, as long as you can sex them, then you can put them in pairs and bring them on board. And so they don't have to be huge. There was something called an elk. What was the giant elk? And the Irish elk, wasn't it? With a span of 12 feet in its antlers. Well, you don't have to take a mature animal like that. That takes up a lot of room. Take them and they can grow their antlers after the flood. Okay. Now the 14 orders, here we have a classification of 18 orders of animals, and you can see the variety of form and shape of animals, and these are animals that are alive today, by and large, and you see they categorize man over here among primates. And it's interesting that the way in which these are grouped together, by the structure of their skeletons, this was back in the middle of the last century, and their appearance, not so much their color or their shape as whether or not they have a certain set of bones in their ears or the way their ribs are formed or something. And so we're grouped along with bats. Isn't that neat? And if you ever called your enemy an evil-tempered old black bat, I knew someone like that once. Well, there's a relationship among animals that has been assumed by scientists, and now we add to that their genetics. And so as the genes of these animals have been translated and deciphered, then they can be grouped more accurately. And so the latest grouping is only 14 orders instead of 18, as you see here. Well, lots of classifications make sense, like the dolphins and the whales. A peculiar one is about elephants and something called a hyrax, which is a tiny animal, but there are certain descriptions of them that make the scientists put them together. Okay, so I think we go down from this to something a little more numerous, and are the animals that are carried on the ark. Now, the top deck where there was light provided about 40,000 square feet. 1,000 pairs of animals could each have an average of 40 square feet of space. I've picked some numbers here so that you can easily see the math. However, only a few dozen are larger than a man, and over 80% are smaller than a house cat. God may not have sent some large and fierce animals to Noah for preservation on the ark, saber-toothed tigers and dinosaurs, for example. So that's kind of a summary of where we are with this story about the animals. Well, let's look at some of the details now. How much variation could have been introduced in these original animals turned loose from the ark Suppose there's a pair of wolves, or two pair of wolves, and then they breed over a period of some thousands of years. How much variation can you get in their descendants? And this degree of variation from wolf to wolf has happened in the last 10,000 years, even by scientific estimates, okay? So it doesn't take long for mutation and selection. Now, in the genealogy of dogs, there's about 130 or so different breeds of dogs recognized by AKA? American Kennel Association. Yeah. And they are supposed to have come from a wolf-like ancestor up here called Tom Arctus. The story goes that there was a Professor Arctus sitting in his laboratory imagining, where did all these dogs come from? He said, they all look like wolves. So let's suppose there was a primitive wolf that gave rise to, in descent, with animals selected by humans for different properties. And so we have, as you see here, everything from a Great Dane and a Beagle and all kinds of, I've forgotten where the Dalmatian is, it's in here somewhere. And so you may see your favorite breed of dog here. And Dr. Arctus was explaining this to a student, and the student who was looking for brownie points said, Tom, that's a good idea. Let's name him Tom Arctus. And so that's how those names come about, you see. Okay, no, that's just a made-up story. I don't know that that's the case. But you can see all of the variation, all of this has happened in the last estimated 10,000 years. Here's the other side of the thing if we eliminated yours. And I'm sorry you can't read all of the labels underneath. It's too small. All right. How about cats? Well, same sort of story here. We've got more than a dozen different kinds of cats that apparently have all come, and this is a recent thing, so these have come from some sort of a progenitor here over the last few thousand years. The one up here in the tree is the same as this one, I think. And then these animals down here are existing cats today, and the animals at the top are all extinct. But here's our house cat over here. And how many different varieties of house cats are there? Well, all of that variation has come recently from cats. And all of those progenitor founder pairs of cats that Noah turned loose gave rise to all of the variation that we have today. And that's entirely possible to get it if we have enough time. Now, we don't need millions of years like scientists thought. In fact, that's next week's story, is when did the flood occur? It didn't occur in 3000 B.C., but on the other hand, it didn't occur in 3 million B.C. either. And so we'll look at that precisely, because we can tell pretty accurately when Noah sailed the ocean blue. Okay. Now, there's an important consideration here. How were the animals on other continents able to find Noah and the ark before the flood? And after the flood, how did they repopulate the other continents? Do you ever think about that? The world is divided into how many continents? Seven? Now. And the question is, how did they get from North America over to Europe or wherever the ark was built? And the question is answered, this is a criticism, of course, but it's answered by science itself. And it's kind of interesting how it happened. There was a man named Theodor Lilienthal, a German, about 125 years ago, who noticed that as accurate maps began to be produced, that the continents looked like they would fit together. You could fit South America into Africa like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. And so he cut out some maps and sure enough fit them together like this, and it looked like it could have all been one single continent in the past. And so around the turn of the century, at the beginning of the 20th century, he proposed this to some geologists, and they said, balderdash, or some equivalent word. And that's impossible. The continents are fixed land masses, and they don't move. At least I can't feel it moving. And so that rested unproven for about 50 years until after World War II, when they mapped the seafloor of the oceans. And they did that, sailing ships around with radar, of course. And there's a ridge that runs down the middle of the Atlantic Ocean that you see here with cracks in it. It's volcanic. And at the very center here, there is fresh lava produced under the ocean, stays under on the ocean floor. And the ocean floor is clearly spreading out, pushing Africa away from South America. And so this has been going on. And they said, well, that's interesting. How fast are we moving if that were the case? And so with the satellite ages that came along and global positioning equipment and so on, they determined that North America and South America are moving away from Europe and Africa at the rate of 2 inches a year. You can't hardly feel it in your feet. But it's happening, and they said, oh, that's great. We can calculate how long it takes to produce an ocean that's 3,000 miles wide. At 2 inches a year, it takes 100 million years. Oh, they love that. And so they've proved that this has all been going on for a long time. With an assumption, though, what is the assumption? That it's a constant motion. But you know, it doesn't look constant, does it? Out here, where it's flat, the ridge didn't build up much. They say, well, that's covered by sediment or something. But actually, this part of the spread could have occurred very rapidly. And now that it's slowed down to 2 inches a year, the lava's building up into mountains, pretty good sized mountains under the ocean at the center ridge between Africa and South America. So, if we assumed that the continents moved apart at the rate of a half a mile here and a half a mile here to build a 3,000-mile ocean, how long would that take? Can you do that in your head? 3,000 years. And that's something kind of interesting, isn't it? It may have been much faster in the past than it is now. And in fact, this sort of thing is required for the story of the gathering of the animals and the spreading of the animals. They all lived on one single land mass at the time of the flood. And this separation has occurred after the flood. Now, the interesting story about that is, we'll come back to this particular one. This is Noah, his three sons. This is all of his descendants. Where do you find this information? Well, it's in Genesis chapters 10 and 11. All those names are there. And how they relate to Noah through his three sons. And there's a very interesting one right here named, well, we'll put an arrow on that one, Peleg. Peleg is a son of Eber. Eber is the ancestor of the Hebrews. And it's interesting, we'll come back to this too in the future, I think, that from Arphaxad we have the Hebrews and the Asians, and we have from Ham we have the Africans and some Arabians, and from Japheth we have the Europeans, you see. And so, but this man Peleg, Eber named him Peleg, which means division. And everywhere this genealogy is given three more times in the Bible, and at each time the notation that accompanies his name is given as well. Genesis 10:25, two sons were born to Eber. One was named Peleg because in his time the earth was divided. What does that mean? I think that's when the continent split. Doesn't seem to mean anything else. But the Bible is very careful. The writers of the Bible are very careful to keep that notation. And so here's what it looks like happened. That for some reason, there was a fracture of the original continent, which is called Pangaea. And so Pangaea is this landmass so that all of the animals had access to the ark. And incidentally, it was warm from pole to pole before the flood. And we're going to take another lesson about the mechanism of the flood. And so we'll look at what science has offered us in the way of mechanisms. But anyway, they began to separate in the time of Peleg. Now notice what happened here at Antarctica. Antarctica now is covered with snow and ice, as is the northern end of the Eurasian continent. India breaks loose from Antarctica and races toward the Eurasian continent and raises the Himalayas when it bangs into it. That's your tallest mountains in the world. And Australia breaks off of Antarctica and sets sail to the northeast. Animals after the flood that got to Australia would have to pass through the ice and snow. And there wasn't any ice and snow in Antarctica at the time of the flood, but afterwards, part of the mechanism of adding water to the earth was a comet that would disintegrate it in the atmosphere, and a lot of the ice was deposited at the poles for interesting reasons having to do with the magnetic properties of the earth. So any animals that went to Australia had to go through Antarctica. And it's interesting what kinds of animals went to Australia. And so you can actually make a mechanism for getting a peculiar kind of animal into Australia. They don't occur anywhere else, kangaroos. And here's several different kinds. These are the... Oh, wait a minute. Let me back up. These, I pressed the wrong thing. These are mice-sized animals, as you see, and rats. These are larger kangaroos. This is a rock, long-tailed rock kangaroo. And, of course, all of these peculiar animals are marsupials. And so they would carry their young in a pouch and be able to traverse Antarctica, even though it was cold now. And other animals wouldn't follow them. And so there seems to have been a selective mechanism of some sort that put marsupials who carry pouched young into Australia as it broke away after the flood. And then, of course, there's this other animal that everybody likes, the koala. In fact, there are animals that correspond to almost all of the varieties of animals that we have in our world. A few of the marsupials live in other places in the world, and you see one on the way to work once a week, a victim in the street called an opossum. But most of them live in Australia. And they couldn't compete with the ordinary mammals, apparently, on even terms, but because they escaped to Australia. Australia has marsupials that correspond to cats and marsupials that correspond to dogs, the dingoes, that correspond to bears and the kangaroos and the rats and the mice and the usual kinds of mammals that we see in our world. So, we have erred in the past in saying that animals can't change. You see, when the problems came in the discussion with atheists who championed evolution as the source of all animal life, and then they said, of course, millions of years to do this because it doesn't happen very fast. We were wrong on two counts to say evolution doesn't happen. Because clearly you look at the dogs and the cats and the animals. Change does occur. In fact, some animals brought to the North American continent from Europe are no longer like the ones their ancestors. The English sparrow in Europe is now a different bird from the English sparrow in America. And that sort of thing. Actually, change happens pretty fast. We call that adaptive evolution. But you see, that doesn't prove the origin of animal life. God made the original ones with the ability to adapt to changing environments because he knew that he's going to have, first of all, a kind of an incubator in a warm world in which these animals grew. And then they're going to have to endure storms and rain and hot and cold and summer and winter. And that summer-winter business that we talked about last week tells us how long ago this happened. And we'll look at that story next week. So it was wrong to say evolution doesn't occur. But on the other hand, it's also wrong to say that evolution explains the origin of living forms. Because there could well be the story that we have here. God created the original animals. There's been some change in their appearance over the time. But the dogs don't turn into cats, and horses don't turn into cows, and that sort of thing. And that apparently is beyond the capability of the mechanisms here. We've made some other mistakes, too, as the evolutionists have. And, of course, as science progresses, you learn some things, some ideas don't survive and other ideas do. And so we have to watch carefully about how we form these arguments. Because you can commit yourself to a position that you can't defend later on. Okay, that's it for today. And I'll try to give you some time to ask questions. I think I said that we would do that today, but this turned out to be a long story. So we'll spend some time on questions in coming weeks. Thank you.